Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today I'm welcoming someone back who really deserves to be back. Sean Brock is very well known in Charleston, South Carolina. He's from the South, not from Charleston, as I recall, but originally. But he is really considered one of the great sons of Charleston with his restaurants McCrady's and Husk. And if you've not been to Charleston or not been to either of those restaurants, I would say it has to go on your must-do list. But today I'm talking to Sean because he is coming out, or has just come out, I think yesterday was introduced, with a new book, Heritage, with a gorgeous, gorgeous photography, unbelievable recipes. It just makes you feel like you're in the South, quite frankly. Everything is lush. The stories are personal. This is a perfect holiday gift. But more than that, I really want to get into the soul of this book. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Great to be here again.
Again. All right. Well, today, yeah, the last time we were at Roberta's, but today we're at the International Culinary Center. So if you're hearing noise in the background, it's New York City. Mm-hmm. So Sean, why this book? Why Heritage? And I would say to people, you have to go back and listen to, we have it in the archives, Sean's first interview on Chef Story, where he really does talk about his background and his philosophy of cooking, and you can hear all about the restaurants. But today, it's about Heritage. So what was the inspiration? Why Heritage?
Well, you know, I started writing this book when we started to open Husk. And that was a really huge moment in my life where I really started to try and understand what it meant to cook Southern food. I mean, I had to really do some extreme research, and I started to realize how important it is to document things. And for once, I felt like I had a story to tell. And that's a really fun moment. You know, when I was doing all the research for Husk, I started to realize how important my childhood was. And how I grew up and how special that was and just how amazingly lucky I was to grow up that way. And so it's so much fun to write those stories in a book and share them with people.
So what is Southern heritage? Your heritage that comes through this. How's it different from mine as a New Englander or someone out in California?
I think what's fascinating about the South is how diverse it is and how different it is. And I've witnessed that firsthand by growing up in the Appalachian Mountains of Virginia and then spending my culinary career in the Lowcountry. I mean, they're two completely different places. And once you start to realize how diverse the South is, then you start to figure out why. And what's interesting is the cuisine of the South is really dictated by the terroir. It's really dictated by geography. And the South is insanely diverse. I mean, it's so many different cuisines when everybody thinks that it's one. So that's been the lesson of my life, and it's been something that I'll chase forever and something I really tried to capture in this book.
Okay, so you're talking to a Yankee here. I don't know. I'm glad you're talking to me, you know. So when you say diverse, is it geographic product or is it cultural influences? And where are you talking from? You're talking Virginia down to New Orleans on north-south from the seacoast into, I don't know, Alabama? Define the South for me.
Well, I think certainly Virginia. That's where I'm from. And Virginia is a perfect example. If you look at northern Virginia, the cuisine there is completely different from the cuisine that you see in the Chesapeake and extremely different from the cuisine I grew up with in the Appalachian Mountains. And to me, that's what's neat about the South is, you know, you start to pick it apart. You start to realize what makes up a cuisine and what defines that word. And to me, that's, like you said, the cultural influences combined with the ingredients that happen to thrive in that region for geographical purposes and climate reasons. And once you start seeing it that way, then you realize how cool it is to study Southern culture. If you look at the cuisine of the Lowcountry, you'll see obviously tons of things from the water, and the growing season there is insane. We can grow tomatoes 10 months out of the year there. That's insane. And you combine the cultural influences of West Africa and France and Italy, and you get this very particular unique cuisine, and that's fascinating to me, just to research that history and to see how each culture added a little bit of something to the pot. It's pretty amazing.
So can you talk to me about Appalachian cuisine and why is, you know, you say it's different. Assume I know nothing about it. So first tell me, what is it? And then has it evolved?
Well, what's great about Appalachian cuisine is how vegetable-focused it is. My meals as a child were mostly vegetarian, you know, and that's crazy to think about because you think of the South, you think about these heaping plates of fried chicken and tons of pork, and that just wasn't the case. I grew up in a very vegetable-focused family where we grew everything, and if we weren't eating from the garden, we were eating from the basement. So that cuisine is really based a lot on preserving food, and there's a huge chapter on that in the book with a lot of my grandmother's recipes and my mom's recipes. And I remember constantly canning and preserving and drying and curing, and those things kind of always made their way to the table. So a classic meal there would be perhaps a product of a fishing trip or a hunting trip. You know, those were really the only kind of meats that we ate, but tons and tons of vegetables. Just picture Thanksgiving, that kind of spread, and then little condiments and pickles and preserves and fermented things, and always a big skillet of cornbread and a big pile of biscuits.
Tell me about the vegetables. Were they root vegetables in the winter mainly? How did you preserve them? And tell me a particular recipe in this book that is special to you.
There's a great little essay that talks about one of my favorite things that my grandmother taught me, and it's this preservation technique that's essentially the same thing you do when you make sauerkraut. It's lactic fermentation, and it's a combination of beans and corn and cabbage, and it's almost like a chow chow, but there's no vinegar. And you take it and you put it into a crock with water and salt. And old timers will put an egg in the shell, not cracked, into the water, and keep adding salt until the egg floats up, almost like you would for making sorbets. And then you put the vegetables in that have been lightly blanched, and then you take a creek rock and put it in a pillowcase, and you throw that on top and you let it sit in the basement for months, and it goes through that same process the sauerkraut goes to, but it gets this really fantastic sourness and funkiness. And then when you eat it, to serve it, you put a little bit of lard in the pan, get it really screeching hot, and throw that fermented vegetable mix in there, and then that sits in the table. And what's really neat about that is as you're eating your fresher vegetables, as you're eating things from the ground, whatever that may be, like you said, root vegetables in the winter and lots of greens, you'll just reach over and you'll grab a bite of that fermented vegetable mix, which is very similar to how you eat Korean food. On the same table beside those fermented vegetables, raw, super crisp, like a crudité of vegetables. So you watch these old-timers eat. They'll take a bite of cornbread, take a bite of sour vegetables, take a bite of cornbread, fresh vegetables, take a bite of cornbread, cooked vegetables, and you have this rotation of eating. It's almost like eating Korean food.
Well, between fermentation and some of the root vegetables, I would say it's very much like it, except for probably flavor. And it's interesting how different cultures that you think may have nothing to do with each other are so closely tied. So from Appalachia, and you're going to the Low Country. How did you make your journey down there, and how does it change? I would imagine the African American influence is heavy throughout, and French.
Yeah.
French. Where do you see these influences, and maybe give us a little historical lesson on when and how they overlay with each other?
Yeah, what was really, really cool is when I went straight from high school to Charleston to attend culinary school, and I hadn't traveled a whole lot, and I was just amazed that this cuisine existed. It was, you know, all of these types of shellfish and all of these great super fresh vegetables, and it just had this this style to it. You know, the history of Charleston cooking is really amazing. If you look back, you'll see a cuisine dating back to the 17th century, which is obviously one of the oldest and first cuisines of America. So when you have that to act as your inspiration, it's pretty amazing because you have all this documented cuisine to pull from, these old dishes, these old recipes like Purlieu and Hop and John. And then you get into the later stuff like shrimp and grits, and you find yourself in the middle of this cuisine that's just incredibly inspiring because it has such strong roots. If you look at the cultural influences, you have the soul of West African cooking. You have that depth, but then you have the refinement of French cooking, and those things combined with the plants that thrive there, especially the pantry of the Carolina Rice Kitchen, and that's what I write a lot about in the book, and that's one of my fascinations, is all the plants that had to be there in the crop rotation to keep the rice growing in a healthy way found their way into all those dishes onto the plate. And once you kind of start seeing that, you see the importance of agriculture, and you see the importance of smart farming, and that was happening forever up until really the Great Depression. And that formed a very specific cuisine, one that I absolutely adore.
So, where did the plantations come into this, and how labor intensive was it, and did it change because of the economic model after the Civil War, perhaps when the plantations were not there? Did the economics change the culture, the food?
Yeah, if you follow the history of rice in the Low Country, you'll see that it was responsible for a lot of the wealth of Charleston for the longest time. Charleston was the wealthiest city, and you can see that in its architecture. You can feel that still to this very day in the city. And if you think about the history of rice, you'll see that in the latter part of the 17th century, it came in and then just grew like crazy all through the 18th century, and then the Civil War occurs. So all of the rice fields are basically abandoned. And what's interesting about that, while it is sad that the rice culture sort of went away, what happened after the Civil War was this really cool moment of experimentation in agriculture. Now, because all these farmers, they don't want to grow rice anymore because the workforce is gone and it's just too big of a project to take on. So you see all these farmers scrambling to find new vegetables to grow. And so you'll go to the market and you'll look at agricultural journals and you'll see farmers growing 30 varieties of cabbage and 20 varieties of carrots. And so I can only imagine what it was like to go to the market there. And that obviously influenced the cuisine. So you fast forward to the Great Depression and our food system really starts to dwindle, obviously, and then World War II. And then by the 1950s.
Wait, why is that? I mean, people, because they couldn't sell the food because people didn't have the money. Where can you elaborate more on the Depression and how that really broke things up?
Yeah, I mean, people were just trying to survive, and you know, obviously the economy was at its worst. And when human beings go into that survival mode, they start to make different decisions, you know, to get by. And I think once you start getting into the late 40s and early 50s, you start to see the introduction of, you know, industrial forms of agriculture. And that's when people started changing plants and engineering them in a way that was better for convenience and not for flavor. If you look at that time period in American agriculture after the Civil War, people were engineering plants for flavor, for the right reasons. And then you get into the 50s and you know, things like Uncle Ben's rice is born, and people are starting to produce food, but it's food without the flavor and the soul that it used to have. And the problem with that is you fast forward to, let's say, the time period where I was in school in the 90s. Here you have all these extremely talented and passionate chefs in Charleston trying to replicate the cuisine of the 19th century and the latter part of the 18th century in the Lowcountry, that Carolina Rice Kitchen cuisine, but no one's growing Carolina gold rice. No one's growing Sea Island red peas. No one's growing Benny. Nobody's growing true sorghum. Nobody's growing real green peanuts. And so what happens is you're cooking food with all this inspiration, but the flavor's not there, because if you start with, you know, products that don't taste like anything, you're going to end up with food that tastes like nothing, and or you're going to have to cover it up with dairy and butter, and at that time it was truffle oil, or anything you can to make it luxurious.
So are you, let's see if I have this right. So you grew up in Appalachia, and you mainly grew up with homegrown products. Mm-hmm. And you came to Charleston, and were you, I mean, at school you must have eaten Uncle Ben's rice in Virginia. I mean, and how did you discover all these products in Charleston? Was it because you were so used to farm products and real flavor that you rebelled when you got down there? Or was it something that you're part of a group that's discovering these old heirloom varieties?
Well, I think looking back, you know, I was learning all these dishes, and I was learning how to make them, and I was learning their history.
Who was teaching them?
Well, I was working in several restaurants while I was in school. In fact, at one point I had three jobs and I was going to school. My biggest mentor was Bob Carter at Peninsula Grill. And at this time in Lowcountry cooking, you know, he was the king, and it was the most amazing restaurant to work at. And I fought really hard to get a job there. And he taught me the foundation of Lowcountry cooking and Southern cooking in that area. And then I went away and moved to Richmond and cooked for a couple years, started cooking Virginia cuisine again. And then something happened. I met Glenn Roberts, and I tasted his grits. And it was like the first time I'd ever had grits in my life, because I grew up with, you know, just normal grits. There wasn't a grist mill in my hometown, which is interesting, because I found out the other day that my great-grandfather owned the grist mill in my hometown, which is pretty neat. It's kind of in my blood, I guess. But I remember tasting those grits, and I remember just, like, thinking, this is one of the most delicious things I've ever had. And I took a step back and realized, wow, it's got to be more than just grits. And I got to know Glenn a lot, because I would speak to him over the phone when I placed my orders, and I had never heard anybody talk about corn like that in my life, you know, like this intense corn flavor. And like, he would talk about the seed varieties and where he found them and which barrier island in the Lowcountry he found them. And he had all these crazy stories, and I just got hooked. And so we became very close friends, and I've just followed his journey. And, you know, his original goal was to bring back Carolina gold rice, because he knew that it was this extraordinary rice based on the history. And he'd finally found some and tasted it, and he was like, yeah, that's it. This is what I've got to do with my life. And then after that happened, then obviously all the plants needed back then were needed again. And so now the pantry is nearly complete in the Lowcountry, and you'll see all those things throughout the book. So without his work, not only would this book not exist, but Husk wouldn't exist. And, you know, I'm not sure what I'd be doing right now.
Okay, we're going to take a break here, and we'll be back in a minute.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and I'm Dorothy Cann Hamilton. And today my guest is Sean Brock from Husk in Charleston, and we're celebrating his brand new book, Heritage, which is absolutely, positively gorgeous. The front cover is arresting. Really arresting. It's these looking at these gorgeous multicolored beans held in the palms of these hands, but the arms are the ones that are really quite arresting, all the tattoos. And I take it they're yours, Sean, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. On my left arm, it's all my favorite vegetables. And that was about a year of collecting those vegetables and deciding and taking them to the artist and taking the actual vegetables and having them eat them and experience them and serving them to him at the restaurant. And,
I didn't realize. Is that a Chioga beet?
That is a Chioga beet.
And a nasturtium, radishes, yeah. Leeks? Or no, it's scallion?
It's a baby leek.
Baby leeks.
Urban sorrel. And
that is?
Borage. Which tastes like oysters.
Really?
Yeah. This is an old 19th century pumpkin. These are Cherokee golden beans. Those are breakfast radishes. There's several varieties of carrots, and it goes on and on. All my favorite ingredients, ramps and chanterelles. And then the other arm is my home state, Virginia, and it's the state bird and the state tree and the state flower, just a constant reminder of where I'm from.
How painful was
it? Everybody asked that, and my answer is always it really, really hurts. I don't care what anybody says.
The colors are magnificent. They truly are. They really do look like, I'm looking at his arm right now. It is the most colorful tattoo I have ever seen and perfectly done. Where was it done?
A friend of mine in Charleston did it, and he has a beautiful eye for color, and so I think that was why it was really important for me to take him the vegetables. The vegetables have their own color palette. You know, they're very special mix. That color of that borage flower is, you know, that's a lot of work, and I got really lucky finding this guy. I think he did an extraordinary job.
I'll say. So tell me, how did you chapter this book? What, you know, when you had to bring Southern, and is it, it's more than low country, because you talk about Virginia, you talk about, it's really a Southern, an homage to Southern cooking. How did you decide to chapter this book?
Well, the book originally started out to be focused 100% on the low country, but as I cooked at Husk every day and worked there, it wasn't a low country restaurant, it was a Southern restaurant. So the book kind of morphed the same way that Husk did. And so I wanted the chapters to be very focused on the products. So, you know, you'll see the first chapter is the garden. And so that's, I wanted that to be the first chapter, because I really think that that's where everything starts. And that's where I grew up. I grew up in the garden, and that was a really important time in my life. And really, my favorite place to be is tromping through the dirt and eating vegetables out of the ground. And then you move on to the pasture, and then you move on to the waterways. And there's a great cocktail section. There's obviously, at the very end, a dessert section that's a lot of fun, because there are no plated desserts. I wanted to do all the desserts of my childhood, and these magnificent layer cakes and recipes from my sister and recipes from my aunt. But what's neat about the book is scattered throughout it are these little how-tos, how to throw a low country boil, how to cook a pig like a barbecue pit master, how to set up a whiskey cocktail station for a party. So there's that element of entertaining as well, because I think it's something that Southerners are very, very good at, and that's entertaining. There's, you know, a great chapter on the Preservation Kitchen that's so near and dear to my heart, and there's an absolutely fabulous basics chapter, which I think it's overlooked a lot, but that's really kind of the foundation of a lot of our cooking.
It's also a celebration of the people. that have influenced you. You want to give us an anecdote about one of them to take it out of the book so give people a little insight?
Yeah, so as you're turning through the book, you'll occasionally see these little essays with a picture. And when we started writing the book, we called them heroes because that's what they really are to me. They're people that have made a huge difference in the way I look at food. And a great example is David Shields, a professor that is at the University of South Carolina, who is my go-to when I have any questions about the history of Southern food. One of those guys where I'll say, you know, what year did the green peanut come into America and exactly where did it come from? And I'll get 72 pages emailed to me of every single document ever produced about anything in any agricultural journal or any farm journal or any cookbook or any newspaper throughout the 19th century. And to have that sort of resource has really been one of the things that's advanced my cooking so much. And so you'll see these essays, they're all people that I'm really, really thankful for.
I want to talk about salad. I noticed that you have a lot of salads in this book, and I don't think that's people put salads with Southern cooking. And I am of the personal conviction that, you know, they say if you want to see how good a chef is, have him make you an omelet. In the old days, you know, the Andre Sultner school, make an omelet. For me, the real test of a chef is a salad. It is so rare that I get a perfectly presented salad, beautifully seasoned, married with great ingredients, and then coming up with a conceptual vinaigrette or buttermilk type dressing. To have something like that, to me, really shows understanding of product, perfect technique, and elegance in eating. And your salads, to me, were so appealing. Why? Why so many salads?
Well, you know, all of my memories, at my grandmother's table, we had a salad every single time that there was lettuce in the field. And that was something that my family was very, very passionate about, was freshly cut lettuces. And we would have them on the table every single day when they were growing. And we would eat them straight from the field a lot. We'd make a salad right in the garden. But to me, I think, like you were saying, it's one of those things that you can't really hide behind a bad salad, you know, because it's...
You're absolutely right.
Well, it's technique is definitely a major factor, but also I think one of the most important things is product sourcing. And I was really, really spoiled when I was a kid. I grew up eating lettuces that were still alive. And I remember my first restaurant job when I was 16. I worked the Garmage station, and they didn't have that luxury. And it was the first time I'd worked in a restaurant. And it was one of those restaurants that had the cardboard box with the plastic bag full of the mesclun greens from Lord knows where. And I just remember tasting those and thinking, like, why would someone pay money for this? Like, people are sitting down at this restaurant and eating this. I feel sorry for them. And it made me realize how lucky I was to have all those memories as a child. And every time I would get a chance to go visit my family, I would just, like, eat tons and tons of those vegetables because I realized how special that was and how lucky I was. And so those kind of things get burned into your memory. And I crave salads every single day, and I probably will for the rest of my life.
Mm. So where do you source your greens now?
Well, we grow a lot of stuff on our rooftop. And then we work with people who are our friends, people who we've been working with for 8-9 years in Charleston, who know the varieties of lettuce we like, who know at what stage of their maturity to harvest them. They know that we like them as soon as they're cut, you know. And so that's one of the beautiful things about being a chef for so long in one city is you really build that network of amazing purveyors and farmers and producers and artisans. And, you know, every chef knows that you're nothing without good product.
Okay, so I want you to tell me about the baked Sea Island red peas. Are peas beans, but you just call them peas? I mean, please explain this. And why are the red peas so delicious? And how can I buy them up here?
Peas and beans, that's really one of my major obsessions. I collect seeds, and I probably have 400 varieties of peas and beans stored away in a freezer, and each bean tells a story of a family or a place or a particular moment in time. I have a lot of my grandmother's peas and beans, and one of the things that I love about these red peas, it was one of the first plants that I was able to taste that came from West Africa during the Atlantic slave trade, and they're insanely delicious. I'll never forget the first time I tasted them. They're a pretty humble looking pea. There's not much to them. You know, a cowpea is called a cowpea for a reason. That's usually grown to feed cattle or for fertilizer. They have great ability to add nitrogen to the soil. So it was never considered a luxury in the Charleston kitchens. It was always something that kind of poor people ate. But we all know that poor people food is the best food and has the most flavor. And these red peas really tell that story. And for the longest time, they weren't available in Charleston, really up until maybe 6 years ago. And I think one of the great things is being able to serve them and tell that story. And I was able to go to West Africa a couple times last year to research a lot of these plants and the origins of Low Country cooking. And I remember the first market I went to, the first thing I saw was about 600-pound bags of these red peas. They were identical to the ones that we were cooking in Charleston. And that immediately just was that common thread. It was that link that I was looking for. And so every time I cook those, I think about that. And this recipe's fun because it's my take on barbecue beans or baked beans, which I think there's a lot of bad baked beans out there. They're all too sweet and covered in bad barbecue sauce. So it's fun to take something that people have had so much of in a bad context and give it to them in this new, flavorful, unique, exciting way.
So the red peas, how does it differ in taste to a navy bean that you could buy in a supermarket?
Well, you know, a navy bean is very creamy and luxurious, where I like to say the red peas are like down and dirty. They're super earthy. I mean, it's like you're eating the dirt. And I love that. I love earthy food like that. It's almost like you're in the garden. When you're eating these peas, your brain just races, and it's like you can see agriculture happening. I love when a plant can do that. And these red peas just have the most intense earthiness that I've ever had in a pea.
Can we buy them up north?
AnsonMills.com.
Okay. All right. Okay. Will do. Tell me about... excuse me. Tell me about some of the desserts. As you said, you've got... well, even before we get to desserts, the pork rind. I love pork rind. I've never made it. What is the secret? What's the key? How do you do it?
Well, our pork rinds are a pain in the butt. but they're worth it. It's one of those things where I obsessed over it, and I knew what I wanted to create because I'd never had it. I wanted a pork rind that when you ate it, you chewed it once or twice, and then it vanished. It disappeared. And the secret to that is long, slow cooking. Mm-hmm. So we cook it at a low temperature forever until you can pinch through it, and then the trick is to really scrape it. Scrape, 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 scrape all that fat away. Because that's usually what ends up stuck in your teeth and makes it chewy. And then once it's dehydrated, then you flash fry it and you get this like pillow of air. This pillow of porkiness.
Pillow of porkiness. Does it matter what kind of pig the fat comes from? Or, I mean, is the source important there?
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to a guy who was obsessed with pigs and pig breeds and raising pigs and chasing pigs and eating them and cooking them. I think, you know, it's just like, you know, it's important to know what variety of lettuce you love. It's the same thing with the pigs. And what's neat about the South is we have these breeds that are indigenous to there and that thrive there. If you look at the ones from the Low Country, you'll see these guinea hogs that came over from Africa, obviously, and they're just these crazy-looking pigs. And then you look at the Ocibal, which is the Spanish pig that has been around for several hundred years and has this crazy look to it, but also this insane amount of fat. And not only a lot of fat, but a very, very sweet fat, because those pigs are diabetic, and it turns out diabetes tastes extremely delicious.
Really?
It does.
Well, I hope we don't get into cannibalization here. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back. Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story and Two. So you all have to listen if you haven't heard before. The first interview, we probably did a couple really on Sean's background and how he got to be Sean Brock today. But today we are celebrating his new cookbook heritage. And I'm going to move right to the dessert chapter that has my mouth watering on Audrey Morgan's apple sorghum stack cake. I've never seen anything like it. I've never heard of a sorghum cake. Tell me about it.
Well, there's a lot about this recipe that I really love. First of all, I found it on a handwritten card from my grandmother at her house, and I still have that, and that's exactly what's on these pages is from her handwritten recipe card. And I grew up with this cake on the counter all the time, and as a kid, it didn't look appealing to me. It didn't look like, you know, I wanted birthday cake looking stuff with big bright colors and sprinkles. So I never really craved it like I do now as a child. And it's great how your palate changes as you grow older. But the basis of this cake is sorghum. And sorghum was something that was really important to my family. Each year in the area that I grew up in, the neighbors would take their sorghum harvest all to one place, and you run it through a mill that's run by a horse, and this horse is walking in circles, moving these stones, and you're feeding the sorghum through that, and out comes this crazy-looking juice, and then you build this huge fire, and you cook down that sorghum, and you take turns skimming away the impurities with a broom handle with a metal dustpan on the end that you've taken a small nail and cut out holes, and that's what you're skimming away the impurities, and that's it's a potluck. So you bring a dish, you bring a covered dish, and the community gets together and they tell stories and they talk about who's going to be the starting quarterback in the high school football team, and they talk about who just had a baby, who's going away to college. And it's those communal things that I think, you know, make a culture so special. And those are some great memories as a kid running around and playing with all the neighbors. So that flavor of sorghum is one of my favorites, and it's getting harder and harder to find true sorghum. So this cake is spiked with tons and tons of sorghum. And what's neat about this cake is it's a stack cake, and that's just this masterpiece in the Southern pantry that started as poor people food. It was one of those things where you were so poor that you could only afford to bake one layer. So when you got together, 10 people would come together, 12 people would come together, they'd all bring a layer, and you stack it up, and you've got a nice cake, especially at weddings and family reunions and things. So, and it's really hard to make. It's really hard to make those perfect layers and to stack them properly. And this one is covered in a whiskey glaze, and it's just one of those things that you eat, and your brain just goes right back to your grandmother's kitchen, right back to those sorghum potlucks, and I think that's what food should be all about, and that's one of the beautiful things about a lot of these recipes is there's these incredible stories linked to them, these memories, this nostalgia, and I think that's one of the most beautiful things about being a chef.
Tell me about the photography, because this photography just makes your mouth water.
The photographer is a very good friend of mine, Peter Frank Edwards, and we've been working together for almost 9 years now. And when you work with someone that long, there's a level of trust between each other, because you know each other. You know, I know what kind of music he likes. He knows what kind of jackets I like. You know, it's funny, we've gotten to know each other so well that I can plate something and just drop it off and trust him to turn a leaf if he thinks it needs to be turned, or trust him to fluff something up, or trust him to actually handle the food. And a lot of chefs would never do that. You know, they would never let a photographer. That's a no-no. You know, photographer would never go putting his hands on a chef's plate or his food. And I think that was really one of the things that was the secret of producing these beautiful images was our trust with each other. I totally trusted him with everything because he's the photographer. He can look through that lens and see what it's going to look like when it's in the book. I can only really see it as a chef sees it on the table in the dining room or on the pass in the kitchen. And so I think that was a major factor in like the emotion that comes out of these images. They're just striking and makes you want to cook.
As you know, we're going to have an American Pavilion at the World's Fair in Milan starting next May in 2015. And what we have to do at the pavilion is give the sense of American food, real American food, to the rest of the world. What do you think we should do? How should we do it? And what is real American food?
One of the great things is the diversity of American cuisine and its history, but also its future. And I think if you look at what made up the various regional American cuisines, you'll see that it was the embracement of culture and the celebration of ingredients. And as we become an older nation, there's more and more cultural influences and newer products and newer ways and different ways of seeing things. So I think, you know, the future of American food is very bright. I think a lot of people are recognizing that. And I think what's happening is if you look all across the country over the last 5 years, you'll see these chefs all of a sudden realizing how special their roots are, how special their heritage is and their family's cuisine and their region's cuisine. And once you start embracing that, then all of a sudden this new type of inspiration occurs, one that you can only unlock if you go down that path. And the food that comes out of that, the result is just a really honest and amazing cuisine. And I think, you know, that's one of the cool things about America is it's so many different cuisines for so many different reasons. And I think, you know, the most important thing would be to show the diversity and to really celebrate that.
So one of my questions is, there are so many great chefs today working all around the world and celebrating their local products and, let's say, the more traditional farming practices and techniques. But one of the questions I think that's out there is, how do we feed the large populations? And for example, in a place like New York City, where we have just in Brooklyn 4 million people living, and then all around the city you've got suburbs, how do we grow enough food using traditional methods that can feed literally millions of people?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and my answer is always the same. I think we have to focus more on taking care of the dirt and understanding what that means. And what that means is obviously not polluting it, but feeding it and nourishing it. And there are several ways to do that. If we can get back to the old-fashioned way of crop rotations and fertilization, then things fall into place. That's the way things are supposed to be. I mean, one of the major problems now is we get so hooked on one thing that we have to have it all the time. We were talking earlier about tomatoes, and that's the same thing. It's like people have to lose this idea that a cheeseburger isn't complete without a tomato. Husk is a perfect example of that. You'll get a tomato on the burger in Husk Nashville when they're in season, and when they're not, you won't. And that's kind of the attitude we have to take, is to let things happen naturally and not force them, and take care of the soil in the meantime.
Mm. Well, for sure. We were talking about the tomato, we were saying that a tomato takes 13 gallons of water to make one tomato. We are water challenged, like the droughts in California and the Southwest. I guess a real question is going to become, how political is it to eat a tomato? How responsible is it today to eat a tomato in a water-challenged environment? And do you see that we're all going to have to change the way we eat, dependent on the soil? I mean, you know, we want everything all the time, and it doesn't grow everywhere all the time. So would you see that people shouldn't be eating tomatoes in the Southwest because there's no water?
You know, I think one of the great things that I'm starting to realize is the importance of education and raising awareness. And I think that should really be step one, is educating people. I mean, because if you don't know that a tomato takes 13 gallons of water to produce, then you're just going to eat tons of them and not realize that you're doing anything wrong or feel any sort of guilt. I think the idea of educating people and raising awareness is really the most important aspect of all this, because the more information we have, the better decisions we make. And that's the thing, is like, we got to realize that every time we're eating something, we're making a decision that supports an idea. And sometimes that's the wrong idea, but we don't know it. So it's our responsibility to teach as chefs and as people in the food world, but it's also the consumer's responsibility to do research. I mean, with the resources that are out there today, it's much easier. But yeah, there's lots of things we can all do, and it's having a better understanding of what's right and what's wrong. And once you know that, and you better make the right decisions, or shame on you.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go, and we're leaving Heritage, tell me if you could take a vacation, and it is not going to be in the southeast of the United States, where would you like to go, and what would you like to eat?
It's been on my mind a lot lately. I want to go to Austin and eat brisket. I had never been to Austin. I love music, and I love barbecue, and I love that type of culture. And I've just been dreaming of eating all this barbecue I've been hearing about in Austin and listening to great music. So that's my first stop when I get a chance to take some time off.
All right, Austin, get ready. He's coming. Have him sign his books. We got to get you on the book tour. Well, our time is up, believe it or not. And I want to just thank you once again for coming by and sharing this just incredible book. And really thank you for reviving in the Southeast this interest in heritage products and making them so accessible, not only through this book, but in your restaurants. Charleston's an amazing city. What's going on down there is so dynamic. It really is an example for, I think, a lot of other regions in this country to embrace what they have and celebrate it. So thanks for coming today.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always so much fun.
All right. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.